Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half hour, maybe you did enough for two half hours, but I think it'll only be one. In the next half hour, we're going to take a look at the reemergence of fascist and far-right elements in Central European politics, not Germany this time, but in Austria and Switzerland, and we're going to take a look at some of the history of Switzerland as one of the epicenters of the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization that I've spoken about in the past, literally the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground, an element that I believe will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs on this planet. It's not what I hope will happen, by the way. It's just what I'm afraid is going to happen, barring a significant change in events. People should, rather than finding fault with my analysis, get busy and try and change those events, because that's the way to go. We're going to begin by taking a look at one of a number of articles that discussed the electoral success of Jörg Haider, the so-called yuppie fascist. This comes from the Los Angeles Times of Monday, October 4th of 1999. This is an article by Carol J. Williams of the Los Angeles Times. It's datelined Vienna and headlined, Far Right Tears Austria's Political Turf, subtitled, Election, Anti-Foreigner Freedom Party Surges to Second Place, Long Ruling Coalition Calls It Quits. And this is about the recent electoral success of Jörg Haider and his Freedom Party, which came in second in the Austrian elections. Jörg Haider, by the way, the son of a Nazi official in Austria, is a fellow who has heaped praise on the Austrian SS, has also suggested that Adolf Hitler had a good employment policy. His Freedom Party was founded originally as a vehicle for the political rehabilitation of Austrian Nazi Party members under Hitler, and he has termed his political agenda the contract with Austria, specifically modeled after the contract with America that Newt Gingrich has peddled in this country. And there are many distinct similarities between the xenophobic and racist platforms pursued by each. Indeed, I discussed that in a three-half-hour segment series about Jörg Haider that's available from Spitfire. Jörg Haider's anti-immigrant thumping has resonated with the Austrian people, and he came in second in the recent Austrian elections. Once again, from the LA Times of Monday, October 4th of 1999, a Carol Williams story we read, in part, the far-right Freedom Party, whose leader once praised the economic accomplishments of Adolf Hitler, soared in Sunday's general elections to become Austria's second-strongest political force and cripple the grand coalition that has ruled this nation for 13 years. Fueled by the party's anti-foreigner battle cry, Austria's most dramatic electoral upset of the post-World War II era edged the center-right People's Party into third place and stripped incumbent Chancellor Viktor Klima's Social Democrats of parliamentary seats and much of their political clout. The outcome throws into doubt how Austria will be governed for the next 4 years, as neither of the traditional parties is willing to cooperate with the Freedom Party's nationalist firebrand, Jörg Haider. A beaming Haider proclaimed himself pleased by Austrian support for, quote, an interesting new political spectrum, unquote, that recognizes his party as a legitimate force in the power structure. On the strength of the charismatic, if unsettling, leader's rostrum-thumping oratory and resonance with blue-collar crowds, the Freedom Party took 27.3% of the vote, compared with 26.9% for the People's Party and 33% for the Social Democrats. Note similarities with not only Newt Gingrich, whom he specifically patterned himself after, but also with Pat Buchanan as well. Pat Buchanan's recent pronouncements sound rather like the back of the Serpent's Walk book that I've read in so many different broadcasts. As noted at the top of the broadcast, this electoral trend to the far right and fascism is something that is not only evident in Austria, it's also manifesting itself in Switzerland as well. That last, by the way, is from the LA Times of 10/4/99. This is from the Financial Times of London of Friday, October 22nd of 1999. This is an article by William Hall and Francis Williams. It's entitled, Right-Winger Leading in Swiss Polls. It's about Christoph Blocher, and it reads in part as follows. Christoph Blocher, B-L-O-C-H-E-R, a wealthy right-wing Swiss businessman who opposes Swiss membership of the European Union and the United Nations, is expected to be the main victor in Switzerland's general elections on Sunday. Note here the opposition to being in the United Nations, again sounding very much like Pat Buchanan. Continuing, the vote is also expected to show that the political divide between the German-speaking majority and the French speakers is widening. Latest polls suggest Mr. Blocher's People's Party, concentrated in the German-speaking part of the country, could overtake the Radical Democrats and Christian Democrats, the two center-right parties which, along with the Social Democrats, have always straddled Switzerland's linguistic divide. The Swiss elections come less than a month after Jörg Haider, leader of Austria's far-right Freedom Party, brought down Austria's coalition government by leading his party into second place in a general election. Mr. Blocher, like Mr. Haider, is a populist politician whose campaign against the European Union and anti-foreigner rhetoric, again note the similarity with American politicians, has played on Swiss voters' concerns about job security and crime. Switzerland has more asylum seekers per head of its population than any other European country. Earlier this week, Mr. Blocher's political enemies leaked a two-year-old letter in which he praised a book on the decline of Swiss freedom by Jürgen Graf, G-R-A-F, who has repeatedly denied that 6 million Jews died in Nazi gas chambers. By the way, later Mr. Blocher claimed he was only praising the title of the book, which he claimed he hadn't read. Well, as forecast in that Financial Times of London article from Friday, October 22nd of 1999, in fact, Christoph Blocher has, in fact, scored major electoral gains in the Swiss elections. Now, reading from the Financial Times of Tuesday, October 26th of 1999. This is by those same writers, William Hall in Zurich and Francis Williams in Geneva. This is entitled, Swiss Swing to Right Dims European Vision. And the subtitle, Coalition Government Surge in Support for People's Party is Biggest Political Upset in 80 Years. It reads in part, Switzerland appears to have opted for an isolationist future after a hard swing to the right in elections at the weekend that will make it tougher for the coalition government to achieve its long-term goals of joining the United Nations and the European Union. The surge in support for the right-wing Swiss People's Party, which is expected to win 15 extra seats in the National Council, or lower house of the Swiss Parliament, is the biggest political upset in Switzerland for 80 years. And note that there are strong similarities between Haider and Christoph Blocher, and in turn between both men and politicians such as Pat Buchanan and Newt Gingrich, the anti-foreigner rhetoric, anti-UN rhetoric being a couple of those components. More about the victory in the success of Christoph Blocher in Swiss elections, this from the New York Times of Thursday, October 28th of 1999. This is an article by Elizabeth Olsen in Geneva, datelined October 27th, and headlined, Swiss Voters Tilting Right Unsettled Traditions. And of the motivating factors for this electoral decision by the Swiss voters, Ms. Olsen writes as follows, of the resentment that many older Swiss citizens felt towards recent revelations about Switzerland's role as sort of a Nazi banking house in World War II. Skipping down, we read, the vote also reflects a continuing reaction to disclosures about Switzerland's role as a banker for some Nazis and for some Jews whose assets seemed to disappear after World War II, Mr. Mueller said. That's Felix Mueller, a commentator for the Swiss daily Neue Zürcher Zeitung. Continuing, quote, this is greatly underestimated, especially for the elderly, he explained, again quoting, there is great anger over this, and that generation helped Blocher build a solid base, unquote. So resentment over the Swiss Nazi banking connections and revelations in that regard also a motivating factor in helping to propel Mr. Blocher to his electoral success. As I stated in some of the past discussions of the Swiss Nazi banking connections, they have been known for a long time. I think it's somewhat hypocritical, in fact, not somewhat, but more than a little hypocritical for the United States to be pointing the accusing finger at the Swiss in light of the massive connections between American industry and finance and the Third Reich, the United States basically having capitalized Hitler and Mussolini to an enormous extent. That's discussed in numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire, RFA No. 1, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, numerous half-hour segments, and including the Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow pair of half-hour segments, which all of those are available from Spitfire. It should not come as that much of a surprise to see reactionary and overtly fascist elements coming to the fore once again in Central Europe, particularly in Switzerland, because Switzerland, although officially neutral, was, in fact, a major Nazi banking center. Again, I think it's hypocritical for America and to point the accusing finger at the Swiss after the massive economic collaboration between American industry and finance in the Third Reich. But nonetheless, Switzerland was a major epicenter of Nazi economic activity, not only prior to and during World War II, but it is a major epicenter of the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization that I've spoken about in the past. For information about the Bormann Group, we're going to turn to the definitive source about the Bormann Organization, and that is Paul Manning's landmark text, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981, the ISBN number 0-8184-0309-8. Paul Manning, for those not familiar with him, was part of the CBS News team that covered the war in Europe along with Edward R. Murrow. He covered the air war in Europe by training to be a waist gunner on a B-17, was actually credited with shooting down an ME-109. He then covered the air war in Japan by training to be a nose gunner for a B-29 and flew missions into Japan in order to cover the air war there. It was Paul Manning who broadcast both the Japanese and German surrenders to the American people over the CBS radio network. He is one of the bravest and best journalists of all time, and sadly his work has been eclipsed, and he suffered emotionally and financially as a result of his bravery in tackling the story of the Bormann Group. Bear in mind that the publisher of Lyle Stewart had his legs broken the week this book was published, and in 1993 Paul Manning's son was murdered in response to his subsequent work on the Bormann Group. His intelligence contacts informed him that had basically been in retaliation for his coverage of the Bormann Organization. That's why I refer to this organization as deadly. It is nothing if not deadly. It is also altogether remarkable, and it is, as one banker termed it in a correspondence with Paul Manning, the most important concentration of money power under a single control in all of world history. And one of the major epicenters of the Bormann Organization is Switzerland. It should not be all that surprising, therefore, to a knowledgeable observer to see Mr. Broecker enjoying the success that he has in that country. What we're going to look at now is not only what the Bormann Organization was, where part of this will be by way of review for some listeners, but in particular, its involvement with Switzerland. As the Third Reich was drawing to a close, or as its military defeat approached, Martin Bormann, and in consultation with Hermann Schmitz of IG Farben, set up 750 corporations in neutral countries, and all of the liquid wealth of the Third Reich went into those countries. The Third Reich looted $180 billion from the occupied nations of Europe, not including the Soviet Union and Greece. That was $180 billion in 1943 dollars. It'd be several trillions now, and that plus all of the liquid wealth of the Third Reich, a sum almost certainly greater than the U.S. national debt in 1999, went into these 750 new corporations, which then became a major epicenter of occult economic power. Paul Manning writes of the Bormann Organization in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, as follows. 750 new corporations were established in the last months of the war under the direction of Reichsleiter Bormann using the technique perfected by Hermann Schmitz. A national of each country was the nominal head of each corporate structure, and the board was a mix of German administrators and bank officials, while the staffing at senior and middle management levels was comprised of German scientists and technicians. In the background were the shadowy owners of the corporation, those Germans who possessed the bearer bonds as proof of stock ownership. The establishment of such companies, usually launched in industries requiring high technical skills, was welcomed in Spain and Argentina, to give two examples, because those governments appreciated that German companies would generate jobs and implement a more favorable balance of trade. Country by country, a breakdown by U.S. Treasury investigators of these new 750 German firms was as follows. Portugal, 58, Spain, 112, Sweden, 233, Switzerland, 214, Turkey, 35, and Argentina, 98. And again, in the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk that I've accessed in the past, there is discussion of the Bormann Organization, although it is not identified as such, and its activities in third world countries, and the enormous capital that it generated. Switzerland is one of the neutral countries that became an epicenter for the Bormann Group and the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, and in particular, Switzerland was used as an epicenter for corporate masking of German assets so that they would not be seized by the victorious Allies. Paul Manning writes of the German capital flow into Switzerland as follows. The movement of German assets into Switzerland had also gone well, Bormann noted from his reports. Flight capital investments had been accomplished principally through the establishment of subsidiaries of powerful German firms. Over half the total German capital in Switzerland was used in setting up holding companies representing IG Farben, Merck, Siemens, Osram, Henkel, and others. A holding company may not trade in any form. It may only hold stock in other companies, but through this device, the existing German firms and the 750 new corporations established under the Bormann program gave themselves absolute control over a post-war economic network of viable, prosperous companies that stretched from the Ruhr to the neutrals of Europe and to the countries of South America. A control that continues today and is easily maintained through the bearer bonds or shares issued by these corporations to cloak real ownership. Bearer shares require no registration of identity, for such shares are exactly what they mean. The bearer of the majority shares controls the company without needing a vestige of proof as to how he acquired them. Thus, the Germans who participated as a silent force in Bormann's post-war commercial campaign, which is sometimes referred to by aging Nazis as Operation Eagle's Flight or Aktion Adlerflug, ensured their command over the industrial and financial institutions that were to move the new Federal Republic of Germany back into the forefront of world economic leadership. In Switzerland, the most substantial investments were in chemicals and drugs and in electrical power and equipment. German investments totaled $300 million, of which bank deposits, cash, and securities amounted to about $250 million, with direct investments about $50 million. Bear in mind, this would have been in the 1940s. It would be exponentially greater than that today, multiplied by 20 or 30. Continuing. In the German-Swiss clearings, Germany's debt, as the new year of 1945 began, was 1,000 million Swiss francs, or $232.1 million. Swiss investments in Germany and pre-war loans to Germany were $445 million. Six Swiss private banks were now used by German firms in the flight capital program. H. Stutzenegger & C., Rochling & Company, Johann Verli & Company, Bank Wadensiel, Basler Handelsbank, and Credinstalt. However, all major Swiss banks were serving the Germans in the massive movement of funds. The big German banks, Deutsche, Dresdner, and Commerzbank, all had their regular Swiss affiliations through which they worked. Deutsche had as its principal connection Credit Suisse, and also did business with the Swiss Bank Corporation and the Banque Fédérale. Funds transferred from Berlin for a client list approved by Bormann went into numbered accounts and were either held there for local investment or soon shifted to neutral nations elsewhere in Europe or overseas to be credited to the accounts of appropriate German corporate subsidiaries or else to entirely new corporations awaiting these startup monies that would enable them to go into business using German patents. As these new corporations prospered, they generated more money and profits, becoming important elements in the Bormann global economic scheme. And again, Switzerland was one of the major epicenters of the Bormann Group's activities. And in particular, Switzerland was the site of a holding company that was one of the major corporate masking devices for the IG Farben chemical company. That was the backbone of German war production and also the backbone of German industrial support for Adolf Hitler, at least from Germany. Henry Ford and others were also prominent supporters of Hitler from the United States. But the IG Farben company is an incredibly important industrial concern, and after the war it was broken up into Bayer, BASF, and Hoechst, H-O-E-C-H-S-T. I'm not sure about the pronunciation of that. Those are the three giant companies which grew out of the bigger, the even more gigantic IG Farben company. And please note that Switzerland was the epicenter for the Interhandel company, one of the major corporate fronts used to mask ownership of IG Farben. And as noted in the section that I just read you, the 750 corporate fronts were set up in conjunction with Hermann Schmitz in using his techniques of corporate masking. Hermann Schmitz, one of the guiding forces behind IG Farben. The Hermann Schmitz Fund is believed, Hermann Schmitz Trust is believed to have gone to the Bormann Group after Schmitz's death. That basically made the Bormann Group equal to the Rockefeller family in terms of their holdings in Standard Oil. Of the Swiss Interhandel company and its work as the its status as basically the front for I.G. Farben. We read as follows in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. This, by the way, is in a conversation between Hermann Schmitz and Martin Bormann in March of 1945. Hermann Schmitz then went on to explain that he had changed IG Chemie to Société Internationale pour Participation Industrielle et Commerciale SA. In German-speaking Basel, the name became International Industry and Handelsbeteiligungen, or AG, or Interhandel. By the way, I'm sure I mispronounced that. Continuing, Interhandel, by the way, capital I-N-T-E-R-H-A-N-D-E-L. Schmidt said he had stipulated that only Swiss were to be on the board of directors of the new holding corporation, which could then declare itself a fully Swiss corporation. The brightest jewel in the Interhandel string of companies was General Anilin and Film Corporation, a holding company in the United States for various American IG Farben companies. It had been organized in 1929. There were 10 members of the board, Schmitz, Bosch, and Greif, G-R-E-I-F, all Farben men, Metz, Weiss, and Kietroff of U.S. companies that sold Farben-manufactured products, and four prominent American industrialists and bankers, Mitchell, Ford, Warburg, and Teagle of Standard Oil. In one instance, Farben gained a large block of Standard Oil stock by selling certain patents to the Standard Oil Corporation. By the way, that's the Standard IG Agreement of 1929, discussed in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, available from Spitfire. Continuing, some American directors of General Anilin had large blocks of GAF stocks registered in their name. The New York Bank of Record was National City Bank, the largest in New York, which is now known as Citibank. In 1929, the board voted Hermann Schmitz president, a position in which he served from 1929 to 1936, while simultaneously serving as head of IG Farben. In March of 1945, Hermann Schmitz was telling Martin Bormann that he hoped this shuffling of name and board membership would prove helpful after the war, when steps would be taken to return General Anilin and Film Corporation to his ownership in Switzerland. The valuable holding company had been seized in 1942 by U.S. authorities as suspected enemy assets. In 1948, a suit was to be filed by certain minority stockholders of Interhandel against the Attorney General of the United States as successor to the wartime alien property custodian and the U.S. Treasury for the return of 89% of GAF of a value of $100 million plus $1.8 million seized in cash in 1942. Interhandel, through its American attorneys, first filed an administrative claim which was denied. The suit then went to the District Court for the District of Columbia, then to the Supreme Court, and back to District Court. The Swiss claim was based on the argument that Interhandel was a Swiss corporation, that it was not, nor had it ever been, an enemy of the United States, and that it owned the shares in question. The American government rebuttal was that Interhandel was the result of a conspiracy between the private bank of H. Sturzenegger, formerly E. Grütert and C., and IG Farben Industry of Germany and others, quote, to conceal, camouflage, and cloak the ownership, control, and combination by IG Farben of properties and interests in many countries of the world, including the U.S. As the case dragged through the U.S. courts, Schmitz would have Interhandel cosmetized even more. Charles Delos, president of the Swiss Bankers Association, would be elected chairman, and the general manager of each of the big three banks would be appointed to the board. They would agree to this because the honor of Swiss banking and its principle of banking secrecy would be at stake. In addition, 25% of Interhandel stock would be registered to the name of Union Bank, whose manager, Dr. Alfred Schaefer, was of known integrity. The Swiss believed the association of such a man of high banking repute at Interhandel would impress American government authorities. But the German connection would still be there. Not only Hermann Schmitz, but also the banking connection of Union Bank of Switzerland, Dr. Schaefer's bank, and Deutsche Bank, which acted in concert on so many deals involving not only IG Farben, but also big Ruhr industrialists such as Thyssen AG, the largest steelmaker in Germany. By the way, I would note that Philippe de Weck of Union Bank, along with Deutsche Bank Chairman Emeritus Hermann Abs, was called in by the Pope to help straighten out the Vatican banking scandals in the early 1980s. An interesting choice of bankers. Another thing to note about the Swiss element of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization is that basically Bormann assets in Switzerland have been used by the Bormann Organization to buy into American blue-chip corporations. That described by Manning as follows. Throughout this period of asset transfer, Reichsleiter Bormann's goal was to have as much foreign exchange as possible in position to all in all neutral nations in both hemispheres. Aside from the Swiss banks, which made all currencies readily available in exchange for goods, trade, or gold bullion sales, the export of German products to neutral nations added to the general foreign exchange funds. Upon receipt of German goods, an agency in Spain, for example the Spanish Foreign Exchange Institute, would credit pesetas to a German-controlled import-export company. With such funds accumulating rapidly in Spain, Portugal, Sweden, Switzerland, and Argentina, Bormann and his group, who were handling the fortunes of 750 new corporations, would use these corporations in neutral countries as cloaks for investing in American companies. Bormann always had a high regard for U.S. blue-chip stocks as a stable investment, consistently purchasing a vast number of shares from the European offices of such New York stock brokerage houses as Merrill Lynch on behalf of the Reich Chancellery and Hitler, until war became official between the United States and Germany and the buying stopped for a time. In 1941, investments in U.S. corporations by German companies and assorted German individuals held voting ownership in 170. Minority ownership was held in another 108 American companies. These businesses cover the following fields: manufacturing, foodstuffs, chemicals, electrical and automobile equipment, machinery and machine equipment, other metal products, petroleum production, refining and distribution, finance, trade, and miscellaneous. American industry, of course, had a financial stake in German industry as well. In that same year, 1941, 171 U.S. corporations had major investments in German firms amounting to $420 million. A listing of these corporations is identical to the general categories under German ownership in the United States. When Bormann gave the order for his representatives to resume purchases of American corporate stocks, it was usually done through the neutral countries of Switzerland and Argentina. From foreign exchange funds on deposit in Swiss banks and in Deutsche Südamerikanische Bank, the Buenos Aires branch of Deutsche Bank, large demand deposits were placed in the principal money center banks of New York City, National City, now Citibank, Chase, now Chase Manhattan N.A., Manufacturers and Hanover, now Manufacturers Hanover Trust, Morgan Guaranty, and Irving Trust. By the way, this book was written, of course, in 1981. Such deposits are interest-free, and the banks can invest this money as they wish, thus turning tidy profits for themselves. In return, they provide reasonable services such as the purchase of stocks and transfer or payment of money on demand by customers of Deutsche Bank, such as representatives of the Bormann business organizations and Martin Bormann himself, who has demand accounts in three New York City banks. They continue to do so. The German investment in American corporations from these sources exceeded $5 billion and made the Bormann economic structure a web of power and influence. That $5 billion, again, was many, many years ago. It would be exponentially greater today. I've been reading from Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, about the Swiss role in the Bormann Flight Capital Organization over the years. The various tapes that I've produced over the years are available from a tape duplication called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. You can reach them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, by email at spitfire@ix.netcom.com. They have a website, spitfirelist.com, with a listing of the various description of the various tapes available from Spitfire. That same list is also available on the KFJC website at kfjc.org. That concludes this program. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.